Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome once again to As It Is. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting information from around the world. We always try to present it slowly and with words that are easy to understand. That lets you learn American English quickly. Today we have two stories for you. First, some exciting news from the American Space Agency. Then, we're off to South Africa. If you want to hear about some delicious food, you won't want to miss this one. If you're ready, let's listen and learn with the Voice of America. The head of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration says the space agency, also known as NASA, plans to land people on Mars in the 2030s. Charles Bolden is the administrator for NASA. He said that 5 years ago, President Obama set that goal for the space agency. Mr. Bolden spoke earlier this month at the Humans to Mars Summit 2015. In his words, the plan is clear. This plan is affordable, and this plan is sustainable. Ann Ball has more about the summit and some of its speakers.
Buzz Aldrin was the second man to step on the moon. He is retired from NASA, but is working to get humans to Mars. He told the summit that we need to stimulate the public to be supportive of a U.S. mission to Mars. The program, Mr. Aldrin said, needs to develop in a series of stages or steps over several years. NASA engineer Brett Drake said that is the idea that several private companies have offered. Explore Mars, Inc. is the group that organized the Humans to Mars Summit last week. The group released a study on the steps required to send people to Mars. They are a new space launch system, Orion spacecraft, a deep space environment for astronauts to live in, and new methods for entry, descent, and landing. Other new technologies needed are solar electric propulsion for power and a vehicle that could land people on Mars. NASA is already working with private partners to develop the technology needed to get humans to Mars. They are working to develop advanced propulsion and habitation, where and how people will live on Mars once they get there. One example is Lockheed Martin's Stepping Stones plan. It calls for beginning flights to the International Space Station using today's vehicles and Orion spacecraft. Later flights will land on Deimos, one of Mars' two moons. NASA also announced a Journey to Mars challenge. The agency is asking for ideas from the public on how to get people to Mars and how they can stay. The ideas could be about shelter, food, water, breathable air, communication, exercise, social relations, and medicine. NASA said people are encouraged to consider innovative and creative elements beyond these examples. The Mars rovers Curiosity and Opportunity are already providing much information as they move across the Martian surface. It is already known that at one point in time, Mars had conditions that could have supported life. NASA's Charles Bolden said that Mars just might help us to unravel the age-old mystery about whether life exists beyond Earth. I'm Anne Ball.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. As promised a few minutes ago, we are now headed for South Africa. Marcia James is here to tell us that many people down there have a taste for something they think is the best in the world. What could it be?
Johannesburg, South Africa is one of Africa's top cities in business and wealth. Its financial area is often called the richest square mile on the continent. As its wealth increases, so does the taste of its residents. Right now, demand is rising in Johannesburg for Kobe beef. Top cooks and professional meat cutters say it is the best beef in the world. It is definitely the most costly. The beef comes from Wagyu cattle in Japan's Kobe region. The beef's fat content makes it rich and melt in your mouth tender. At Brayside Butchery in Johannesburg, butchers slice through carcasses, the remains of a dead cow. Caroline McCann is the owner of the meat store. She is a huge fan of Kobe beef. The Japanese taught her how to cook it. Drop thin pieces into boiling miso soup for a very brief time.
And with chopsticks, just 3 to 5 times, put the meat through the broth and enjoy. And you do. It is just delightful. It's incredibly creamy, almost like eating a slab of butter. So it's very rich. You certainly can't eat a lot of it.
Caroline McCann has visited Japan. She says the meat currently costs more than $1,000 a kilo on international markets. McCann says Kobe farmers understand that the better they feed and treat their animals, the better their beef will taste.
It's kind of the ultimate diet. So they have this wonderful massage once a day, and then they get fed beer every day. Most people I know put their hands in the air and beg to be a Wagyu. And so what they get is they get roughly a liter and a half of hops every day. So it's a high carb, high sugar, which also helps them to bulk up.
An order is ready in the kitchen of a restaurant in Sandton, a wealthy area of Johannesburg. Businessman Dennis Atwood is eating Kobe-style steak.
It is of the best in the world. It's dry on the outside, quite pleasant to eat. The flab is certainly intense.
Caroline McCann says Kobe-style beef is something that wealthy people from all over the world want.
The people that are looking for this are the same people that are very well-traveled, very well-read, very well-informed. They would have eaten at some of the top restaurants.
She says there also are a lot of people from elsewhere in Africa who visit Johannesburg for business, and they too want to eat Kobe beef.
So a lot of people from Ghana and Kenya and Congo who come with significant money, come with a significant understanding of food internationally, and they're also actively seeking out this kind of product.
Very soon, Caroline McCann says she is set to import Kobe-style beef from Australia, where Wagyu crossbreeds are growing. She plans to sell the beef for 1,300 rand, or more than $100 a kilo. But it will obviously sell for much more at restaurants. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to The Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. A deaf and blind woman from Australia has become the first person to make a telephone call using a device that converts speech into Braille. Braille is a form of writing that uses raised dots on a surface that can be read by touching it. The technology is being tested for the first time in Australia and the United States. One test involved a simple phone call between two sisters. Michelle Stevens is deaf and blind. Ms. Stevens says the Braille telephone will end years of feeling isolated or feeling alone and apart from others. She is one of five Australians who is taking part in the new trials or tests. These trials will take place at about the same time in Australia and the United States, where the technology was developed. Ms. Stevens's vision suffered damage because she was born prematurely or born too soon. She lost her hearing from serious ear infections. The Braille telephone system, she said, will be a great help to her and others. Ms. Stevens told VOA's Phil Mercer that this telephone system will be one way to break the isolation of deaf blindness. She adds that with future developments, the phone system might be able to give deaf-blind people more job opportunities. Not being able to communicate in the office or on the telephone is a major employment barrier for people who are deaf-blind, said Ms. Stevens. However, the phone system is expensive. It costs about $2,500. The phones work by transferring spoken words onto what is called a dynamic Braille display. A similar trial will also take place in the United States in a few months. Christopher Engelke is a director with the U.S. company Ultratech. He will carry out the trial in the U.S. Mr. Engelke says the Braille phone system is an exciting project. He describes the system this way. A deaf person, or one who is hard of hearing, uses the phone just like any other phone. However, subtitles, or captions, of what is said appear on the phone's touch screen.
The way that the whole system works is a deaf or hard of hearing person who speaks for themselves would use the phone just like any other phone, except that much like getting subtitles on your TV, you get subtitles or captions to the conversation appearing on a screen, although for a Braille user, they could read those captions in Braille bumps on a dynamic Braille display. So they'd listen to as much as they can, speak with their own voice, and then read everything that's being said to them by reading the Braille on the phone itself.
Mr. Engelke explains that vision-impaired people would listen to as much as they can, speak with their own voice, and read everything that is being said to them from the Braille bumps on the phone. Developers of the device say it could change the lives of those who cannot see or hear. In Australia alone, it is estimated that there are 330,000 people who are deaf and blind. Some groups say that number is likely to reach 1.2 million by 2050. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report from VOA Learning English. For more health and lifestyle stories, visit our website, voalearningenglish.com. I'm Ana Mateo. Don't go away. Coming up next is The Making of a Nation.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On June 5th, 1944, a huge Allied force waited for the order to invade German-occupied France. The invasion had been planned for the day before, but a storm forced the delay. At 3:30 in the morning, the Allied commander, General Dwight Eisenhower, was meeting with his aides. The storm still blew outside the building. General Eisenhower and the other generals were discussing whether they should attack the next day. A weatherman entered the room. He reported that the weather would soon improve. All eyes turned toward Eisenhower. The decision was his. His face was serious, and for a long time he was silent. Finally, he spoke. "Okay," he said, "we will go." And so the largest military invasion ever known, D-Day, took place on June 6, 1944. The German leader, Adolf Hitler, had known the invasion was coming, but he did not know where the Allied force would strike. Most Germans expected the Allies would attack at Calais, but they were wrong. Eisenhower planned to strike along the French coast of Normandy, across the English Channel. The Second World War was then almost 5 years old. The Germans had won the early battles and gained control of most of Europe. But in 1942 and 43, the Allies slowly began to gain back land from the Germans in North Africa, Italy, and Russia. And now, finally, the British, American, Canadian, and other Allied forces felt strong enough to attack across the English Channel. Eisenhower had 150,000 men and 12,000 planes for the attack. But most importantly, he had surprise on his side. Even after the invasion began, General Erwin Rommel and other German military leaders could not believe that the Allies had really attacked at Normandy. But attack they did. On the night of June 5th, thousands of Allied soldiers parachuted behind German lines. Then, Allied planes began dropping bombs on German defenses. And in the morning, thousands of ships approached the beaches, carrying men and supplies. The battle quickly became fierce and bloody. The Germans had strong defenses. They were better protected than the Allied troops on the beaches. But the Allied soldiers had greater numbers. Slowly, they moved forward on one part of the coast, then another.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force.
General Dwight Eisenhower.
This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, I say, continue your passive resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy.
The Allies continued to build up their forces in France. Within 1 week, they brought nearly 90,000 vehicles and 600,000 men into France, and they pushed ahead. Hitler was furious. He screamed at his generals for not blocking the invasion, and he ordered his troops from nearby areas to join the fight and stop the Allied force. But the Allies would not be stopped. In late August, the Allied forces liberated Paris from the Germans. People cheered wildly as General Charles de Gaulle and free French troops marched into the center of the city. The Allies then moved east into Belgium. They captured the port of Antwerp. This made it easier for them to send supplies and fuel to their troops. Only when Allied troops tried to move into the Netherlands did the Germans succeed in stopping them. American forces won battles at Eindhoven and Nijmegen, but German forces defeated British Red Devil troops in the terrible fight at Arnhem. Germany's brief victory stopped the Allied invasion for the moment, but in less than 4 months, General Eisenhower and the Allied forces had regained almost all of France. At the same time, in 1944, the Soviets were attacking Germany from the east. Earlier, Soviet forces had succeeded in breaking German attacks at Stalingrad, Moscow, and Leningrad. Soviet forces recaptured Russian cities and farms one by one. They entered Finland, Poland, and Romania. By the end of July, Soviet soldiers were just 15 kilometers from the Polish capital, Warsaw. What happened next was one of the most terrible events of the war. Moscow radio called on the people of Poland to rise up against the German occupation forces. Nearly 40,000 men in the Polish underground army listened to the call, and they attacked the Germans. The citizens of Warsaw probably could have defeated the German occupation forces if the Soviet army had helped them. But Soviet leader Joseph Stalin betrayed the Poles. He knew that many members of the Polish underground forces opposed communism as much as they opposed the Germans. He feared they would block his efforts to establish a new Polish government that was friendly to Moscow. For this reason, Stalin held his forces outside Warsaw. He waited while the Germans and Poles killed each other in great numbers. The Germans finally forced the citizens of Warsaw to surrender. The real winner of the battle, however, was the Soviet Union. Both the Germans and the Poles suffered heavy losses during the fighting. The Soviet army had little trouble taking over the city with the help of Polish communists. And after the war, the Free Polish Forces were too weak to oppose a communist government loyal to Moscow. Adolf Hitler was in serious trouble. Allied forces were attacking from the west. Soviet troops were passing through Poland and moving in from the east. And at home, several German military officials tried to assassinate him. The German leader narrowly escaped death when a bomb exploded in a meeting room. But Hitler refused to surrender. Instead, he planned a surprise attack in December 1944. He ordered his forces to move quietly through the Ardennes forest and attack the center of the Allied line. He hoped to break through the line, separate the Allied forces, and regain control of the war. The Germans attacked American troops, tired from recent fighting in another battle. It was winter. The weather was so bad that Allied planes could not drop bombs on the German forces. The Germans quickly broke through the American line. But the German success did not last long. Allied forces from nearby areas raced to the battlefront to help. And good weather allowed Allied planes to begin attacking the Germans. The battle ended by the middle of the following month in a great defeat for Hitler and the Germans. The German army lost more than 100,000 men and great amounts of supplies. The end of the war in Europe was now in sight. By late February 1945, the Germans were forced to retreat across the Rhine River. American forces led by General George Patton drove deep into the German heartland. To the east, Soviet forces also were marching into Germany. It did not take long for the American and Soviet forces to meet in victory. The war in Europe was ending. Adolf Hitler waited until Russian troops were destroying Berlin. Bombs and shells were falling everywhere. In his underground bunker, Hitler took his own life by shooting himself in the head. Several of his closest aides also chose to die in the Führer bunker. One week later, the German army surrendered to Eisenhower and the Allies.
Yesterday morning, at 2:41 a.m., at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command.
British Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Long live the cause of freedom.
The defeat of Germany was cause for great celebration in Britain, the United States, and other Allied nations. But two facts made the celebrations less joyful than they might have been. One was the discovery by Allied troops of the German death camps. Only at the end of the war did most of the world learn that the Nazis had murdered millions of innocent Jews and other people. The second fact was that the Pacific War had not ended. Japanese and American forces were still fighting bitterly. The war in the Pacific will be our story next week. Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.